Support comes from Gemma, architects, planners, and designers seeking to bring joy to their clients and communities. Details at gemastl.com.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. While the General Assembly special session and the governmental response to the May 16 tornado have been top of mind for a lot of Missouri policymakers, it's impossible to close this week's show without talking about other national events that are grabbing people's attention. That includes President Trump's decision to send members of the military to California in response to protests over immigration enforcement. It's a move that has sparked furious debate, especially since it was done over the objections of California Governor Gavin Newsom. Earlier this week, I spoke with Missouri Senator Eric Schmidt about Trump's handling of the protests and whether his posture toward immigration enforcement is missing the mark. But to start off this conversation, I asked the Republican senator about Trump's decision to approve federal aid to help St. Louis area tornado victims. Here's my conversation with Senator Eric Schmidt. Now, before I ask this question, I do think it's important to note for context that in past administrations, the average time between when a disaster happens and a president signing a disaster declaration is usually around 6 to 8 weeks. So a 3-week window is not especially unusual. But I do have to ask, especially since Kentucky got a major disaster declaration for the same series of storms in 6 days, did this process take too long, in your view, for this federal aid to come to St. Louis?
I mean, I think the context that you gave about typical timing is important here. I'm glad it happened. We were able to get that declaration for the storms that happened earlier in the year that also included St. Louis County mostly, almost exclusively St. Louis County and other parts of the state. But I'm glad it happened, and it was a very bipartisan effort. Was in constant contact with the mayor about it, Governor Kehoe. I talked to President Trump himself about it. Talked to Susie Wiles, his chief of staff, about it specifically, other people in the administration, to make clear that it was a priority for us. We had seen the devastation. I had been there on the ground the next morning, had been back with the mayor to tour some of what they were doing as far as their internal operations on the response, and also went around. And I'm back every weekend, so I'm in St. Louis and saw the damage myself. So I think that they handled it. They did a thorough review. No timetable, I think, when you're dealing with something like this is fast enough, but I'm glad it got done. And I think it's a testament of when we work together, these kinds of things can be accomplished in really difficult circumstances.
This disaster declaration occurred in the same week that President Trump told reporters that he wants to phase out FEMA after the 2025 hurricane season. And look, I'm willing to entertain the conversation that there should be a more direct funding stream to state and local governments to handle disasters, because FEMA has historically been very slow to react to things like this. But my question for you is, if this phase out doesn't come with a significant amount of money going to states, I think we've seen with the St. Louis situation that they're not going to be able to handle major disasters without federal money. So where does kind of the balance go from giving state and local governments more autonomy to do disaster response, but also making sure that the federal government provides money to actually execute things?
Yeah, look, I think FEMA is ripe for reform, and I think that's a good starting place. And I think you could get broad agreement on that fact. It often doesn't move quickly enough. It's been riddled by even some scandals at the end of the Biden administration, where people were making determinations based on what kind of yard signs were in people's yard, that there's no place for that kind of politics as it relates to disaster assistance. We're all Americans. If it happens in California, or if it happens in Missouri, or if it happens in Georgia, there's a reason why you have federal disaster relief. Getting to the more reform-minded view of this, I do think, as you saw in St. Louis, I think it's best to just sort of think of that example. You had the locals on the ground. You had the state on the ground. We were able to unlock tens of millions of dollars earlier in the year for state disaster assistance grant funding. So we worked with Secretary Noem. I was on a phone call with her and Governor Kehoe. You know, what's the status of this grant funding? That was unlocked. That allowed them, for example, the a lot of those emergency disaster relief agencies that the state controls to be on the ground in St. Louis that day. So we were very happy that we were able to do that. But the punchline is, I think the locals are better suited to make these determinations. And so what FEMA effectively is kind of a conduit of federal funds. So if there's a better way to do it, for the federal government, of course, to have a role in that, to empower the locals in a more timely way, I would support that. So, but until you see the contours of what that exactly is, you know, you'd want to pump the brakes a little bit. But I do think we can do better than what we have now. I mean, in Republican or Democrat administrations, we've seen the failures of FEMA. And some of that's because of the bureaucratic maze that exists. So part of, you know, my effort on this and others to unlock the St. Louis disaster relief funding was to try to cut through that red tape, to not get, you know, sort of bottled up with a mid-level bureaucrat. And I think because of some of the relationships that I have, we were able to be effective there. Again, not exclusive to me, but I think everybody pulling in that direction is helpful.
I want to turn to what is going on in Los Angeles right now. And before we talk about whether President Trump has the authority to send the National Guard over the objections of California Governor Gavin Newsom, which is going to be decided in a court, I want to actually talk about the crux of what the protests are. And that is that ICE officials have stepped up high-profile raids against people suspected of being in the country without legal status. I mean, there has been a backlash to this type of immigration enforcement, even in Missouri, which you saw in Kennett, where somebody who is originally from Hong Kong was detained by ICE, which caused like a very big backlash in that conservative community. So my question for you is this really an efficient way of immigration enforcement going after people that may have technical violations of their immigration status instead of hyper-focusing on people that may be in the country illegally and may have fundamentally and clearly committed crimes where they need to be deported?
Well, let's be clear. The situation in L.A. started with ICE agents trying to break up a criminal enterprise. These were illegal aliens that were connected to the cartels, and that was sort of the epicenter of the LA unrest and the riots that have happened since then. Do I believe that we should enforce federal law to deport illegal immigrants on a mass scale? I do. And President Trump ran on this. This is not a surprise. This was put squarely in front of the American voters last November. There were two big issues. There was immigration and there was inflation, right? And so President Trump was very clear. We are going to, the 15 million people here illegally, we're going to start with the worst of the worst, but we're actually going to enforce federal law. And if you don't enforce it, the law really doesn't mean much. I think what you're seeing happening right now on the left is they didn't think they were going to lose. They didn't think Trump was ever going to come back. And this effort through NGOs and other organizations to get people here, they're very upset that people might have to go. And it's incredibly dangerous. When I was Attorney General in Missouri, we were engaged in some litigation. I went to the border myself. The amount of human trafficking that takes place with women and children being sexually abused and trafficked to the tune of $100 million a week, that's the economic value of that. So there's no compassion, in my view, or the compassionate take isn't we shouldn't be deporting illegal immigrants. The cartels need to be delivered a message that their efforts, which they gain economically from, aren't going to work anymore. And now you see, our Senate conference just spoke with Tom Homan yesterday. These are record low numbers, like 12 gotaways as opposed to thousands and thousands under the Biden administration. They just weren't interested in enforcing the law. And now President Trump is. So you can have a debate about where and when, but nobody has a right to be here illegally forever. They just don't. And if you believe that, you don't really believe in a sovereign country. So I think that it's sort of a moment now where we're going to have this big debate. And I can't believe, actually, that my Democrat colleagues are going to make this their hill to die on again. But here we are. You've got one of my colleagues that was, you know, down in El Salvador with an MS-13 gang. Remember, he's now back and he's going to be tried for trafficking human beings again.
Has it been clearly defined whether that person is an MS-13? I think there is a lot of dispute over whether that's actually true or not.
Well, according to an immigration judge, he was. And now he's going to stand trial in the United States again, so we're going to actually get a clearer picture of who this guy was. But again, I just think it's, you don't need to swing at every pitch in politics, and I feel like the Democrats on this immigration issue, they're going to be on the wrong side of it again. The American people, even recent polling this past weekend, support President Trump's response. They support deporting people who are here illegally, and of course, the worst of the worst. So I think that you're going to see probably more of this as the left grapples with the idea that you have a president who wants to deport illegal criminals.
But let's get into a broader conversation about the maximalist enforcement of federal law. You don't see DEA agents going into dispensaries in Missouri raiding marijuana sellers, even though that's federally illegal. You passed a law saying that TikTok had to be sold from a Chinese entity, and TikTok still exists. I understand what you're saying about people wanting maximalist immigration enforcement, but if you're not doing that for other areas, isn't that not a consistent application of actually enforcing federal laws?
Well, I would draw a distinction on two fronts. First is, this issue was front and center. You didn't have the President of the United States running on the two issues that you mentioned. You had the President of the United States saying, there are 15 million people that came here in a four-year period of time through an effort of mass migration, and he's going to confront that mass migration with mass deportation. So the issue was squarely in front of people. He ran on it. I think that's, you know, an important thing to point out. And also, the level that we've never seen anything like this, Jason. I think you're going to have a response. And I think that, again, the Democrats were engaged in this effort, and it was electoral politics at the heart of it. They thought that actually would affect redistricting. You don't have to be a citizen to be counted in the census. So this was a much larger play, and they lost. And elections have consequences, as many people have said. And one of the consequences here is we have a president that's going to enforce immigration laws. And that's just going to be the reality. That's not going to change. So all the kicking and screaming and the firebombing and the Molotov cocktails isn't going to change that reality.
Well, let's go to the specific dispute I talked about earlier. I'm not going to make an argument that there hasn't been violence in these protests, because they have. I have eyes. I saw that autonomous car on fire. I think the question, though, is whether this constitutes rebellion or insurrection. I mean, I know we could play the whataboutism game for every question I'm going to do, and maybe I am. But I think if President Obama had commandeered the National Guard during the riots in Ferguson and, like, ordered the National Guard to start shooting people, you would have probably called for President Obama's impeachment as a state senator. So I think this is a real important question.
I've known you for a long time, Jason, yeah. But I don't know that. I just thought it was a presumptuous take to know how I would respond to the unrest in Ferguson, whether or not.
But can you get? Could you address the point about who has the right here to call out the National Guard?
The president has the absolute right. If federal agents like ICE agents are being attacked, they're throwing bricks off of overpasses at federal agents. Federal buildings are at risk and being firebombed. When that happens, the President of the United States has the ability to protect those assets and people. And that's what's at stake here. I think what is telling, though, you know, you have some Democrats now acknowledging the violence, even though they were in denial at first. But what you don't hear any Democrats saying, which is sort of the tell here, which is, you know what, everybody needs to take a step back here and let these ICE agents do their job. And the reason why you won't hear that is because they want to dismantle and defund ICE, and they don't actually believe in enforcing immigration policy in this country. The laws that have been passed by the Congress and signed by the president, including, by the way, Bill Clinton, and including, by the way, Barack Obama. So really, the last 4 years, Jason, I would say, is a real departure, even for Democrats, to somehow not even accept the fact that we would be deporting people who are here illegally. Barack Obama deported millions of people. Bill Clinton deported, I think, 12 million people. So this is not a new concept. I just think kind of politically where we're at, somehow this has become more controversial. And maybe it's because President Trump's in office. That could be part of the explanation. But again, I think most people support a president enforcing the law.
In the last couple of minutes we have, I do want to shift to the Big Beautiful Bill, which is, I think it's a great name for, regardless of what you think of the substance, I think that is a good name for this. It rolls off the tongue. We're probably going to be talking about this a lot more, and we probably need to spend more than 2 or 3 minutes on it. But I do want to focus in on the Medicaid aspect of it. I think there will probably be some sort of work requirements. I think that has been agreed with by pretty much every Republican in Congress. I think the disagreement, though, comes from, like, things that are going to make Medicaid more expensive for the states. I think one thing that I've been paying pretty close attention to is restrictions on the ability of states like Missouri to tax healthcare entities like hospitals. I'm pretty sure that when you were a state senator, you dealt with FRA reauthorization on a semi-regular basis. How are you going to make changes to Medicaid in particular without sending Missouri's budget into a cataclysmic tailspin?
Well, I do think, I mean, having seen it myself, I do think there are some reforms. I mean, I think the FRA, it sort of juices up payments and then you get reimbursed for it. And the federal share goes up beyond the typical, say, 60-40 share. Like that, objectively, that's true, right? That objectively. I remember in Jeff City, a lot of people call it free money. I mean, that's not, you know, that's probably not a good way to look at it. So maybe there are some reforms that can be had there. But I would say this. The discussion, and I've been pretty clear on this, benefits aren't going to be affected unless you're one of the 1.4 million illegal immigrants in this country that are on Medicaid. I think that that will be a provision that holds, that you will not be able to access taxpayer benefits if you're here illegally. And I also think, you know, making sure that the people who are eligible are receiving the benefits. I think the program has a lot of importance, especially for those who need it most, individuals with disabilities. I'm actually working on a provision to help strengthen this for people who are most vulnerable. And I think that's something that we can kind of all come together on. So I think that there's been a lot made of sort of Medicaid cuts. That's just not going to happen. It's just not true. But I do think the system, there can be reform with waste, fraud, and abuse. I know that's a term that's used, but there's a lot of it. And if there's anything that came from sort of the DOGE efforts, is that it exposed a lot of this. You have new technologies and new tools to uncover a lot of that waste, fraud, and abuse. And for me, it's about strengthening the system then that serves our most vulnerable. And I have a clear track record on that. That's who I am. And that's who I'm always going to be. And that carried forward in this debate as well.
You mentioned DOGE. How damaging do you think Elon Musk coming out against this bill has been for it to be passed in the form that it came out of the House? It was going to change in some ways, but like, love him or hate him, Elon Musk has a lot of fans, especially among the younger male base that voted for Trump. Did he basically kill this effort by saying that this is going to explode spending beyond a level that is reasonable for people like him?
Look, I think I've gotten to know Elon Musk through this process. I think he's very sincere in his efforts to find real savings, structural savings. And I think DOGE went a long way in doing that. There's still more to do. I think he cares about the skyrocketing national debt. And those are concerns that I share, too. And I think that we're going to have a chance as that House bill, the Big Beautiful Bill, has made its way over to the Senate now. We want to make it more beautiful. I was in the Oval Office just yesterday talking to President Trump about this with some other senators about how we can do that on the Senate side. But I'm confident, and it's, I want to be clear, President Trump is the leader of this party. I mean, he ran on these issues. He's expanded the base. I feel very much at home with this party now, having grown up in North St. Louis County in a working class neighborhood. So I think what President Trump has done is historic with the comeback, and he had an agenda. And I think whether it's no tax on tips or no tax on overtime, or, you know, all those sort of things, that making sure we don't have a $4 trillion tax increase by not extending these tax cuts for middle class families, that's all really important for us to do. I'm confident that we're going to come together and do it. The margins aren't huge, but we're working in the Senate. We're having meetings every day about how do we put our package together, how do we work with the House, how do we work with the White House to end up with a big, beautiful bill sometime in July.
That was Missouri Republican Senator Eric Schmidt talking with me earlier this week from his office in Washington, D.C.
The Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air is produced by Jason Rosenbaum Alex Hoyer, Emily Woodbury, Danny Wisentowski, Maya Norfleet, and Elaine Cha.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.